Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. Well, it's almost time for Linus to go and sit in the pumpkin patch and wait for the great pumpkin. Other children will be carving scary faces into their pumpkins, while some adults actually think of the pumpkin as a vegetable. If they do, they can take the pumpkin and add it to soups, salads, souffles, and stews. If pumpkin is not your thing, it's apple season, too. So let's dig in. Nicole Spyridakis writes from San Francisco about food and travel on her blog, Cucina Nicolina. She has written a piece for Kitchen Window Online about what she cooks during pumpkin season.
Hi, Bonnie.
How are you?
Good.
You find pumpkins are not just for carving scary faces into. You actually use them to cook.
Right. I use pumpkins, as most people might use, say, butternut squash, which I actually like to say that pumpkins are butternut squash's cousin in a way. They're very similar nutritionally and also how you prepare them, but they taste a little bit different, and I kind of prefer them, actually.
How would you describe the flavor? I mean, what makes it different from a squash?
Well, it's a lot smoother in a way. It's also a bit sweeter, but not too sweet, and it's kind of very mellow taste.
There are a variety of pumpkin types, and the great big ones, I guess, are mostly for carving. Can you eat those also?
You can eat them. What I found, actually, is the larger the pumpkin, kind of the more watery the taste. So if you want to have that really pure, clean pumpkin taste, what I've been recommended at my farmers markets is to get the smaller ones that are called sugar pumpkins. And you will see them when you're in your grocery store or your farmer's market, and they're a lot smaller, and they're very bright. So I think it goes for the same I found with zucchini as well. Like, if you buy the smaller zucchini, it's more flavorful. Also, it's easier to cut.
Yes. The larger ones, aren't they grown primarily to make jack-o'-lanterns out of?
Yes. I mean, it's pretty obvious. But I think before I really, you know, knew what I was doing when I was younger, I think I thought there was only one pumpkin for, you know, only one variety.
Well, are there a lot of varieties?
There are a few. And I actually found, you can see some of the decorative ones, or they seem decorative, you know, those small squashes, the almost mini pumpkins. You can actually cook with those as well.
Really? What can you do with those?
Well, those would be great for doing a puree with. You could even roast them whole, stick them in the oven, probably roast them for about 15 minutes, and then take it out and kind of pull it apart. And it's amazing what the oven can do. It just breaks it all down and makes it very soft and delicious.
And brings out the sugars, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What's an easy, straightforward way to roast pumpkin?
Sure. You just take your pumpkin and cut it probably, you could probably cut it into about 8, so fairly thick slices. Scoop out the seeds, put it in a baking dish, drizzle over with some olive oil and salt, and then bake in the oven for about 15, 20 minutes.
How hot was the oven, did you say?
About 375, 400.
And then you just eat it straight out of the...
You can eat it as it is. Some people like to put maple syrup on it. Mm. If you want to go a more savory route, you can serve. I sometimes just have some roasted potatoes and a salad, and it's actually a pretty complete meal.
Getting back to the pumpkin seeds, this was one of my favorite things when I was little. You'd scoop out the pumpkins while you were carving it and then roast the seeds. Did you do that?
We did. My mom did that. She would soak them in salt water and then dry them in the oven, and it was great.
And so you can eat them as a snack or use them in other foods.
Mm-hmm. One of the recipes that I included in this piece was for a sort of pesto, actually, made with pumpkin seeds rather than pine nuts.
And those are called pepita
in
Spanish-speaking countries. In your piece for Kitchen Window Online, you give recipes for the soup with pesto you mentioned, a souffle, baked pumpkin with white beans, and a pumpkin bread. What other things do you use pumpkin for?
Well, I've actually made my little Halloween tradition, grown-up tradition, is I make cupcakes, and I just use a pumpkin puree in the cupcakes. It gives sweetness without being too heavy, and I really enjoy using it because it feels healthful, but it also tastes very good. So I do cupcakes, and I have made a cake. You can make a pumpkin cake, and of course pie. I love pumpkin pie, but I think it's probably because I like pumpkin pie so much that I was wanting to explore how to use pumpkins outside of that, because can't eat pie every day.
We may want to. What do you season your pumpkin pie with?
Oh, I just use the traditional. It's pretty simple, just a little cinnamon and nutmeg.
I once made a pumpkin flan for Thanksgiving that was wonderful.
Oh, that sounds great.
Yeah, it was delicious.
Actually, yeah.
Think about that.
Well, I've also seen sweet pumpkin souffles, and I did a variation on that, but I made it savory.
Pumpkin does seem to lend more flavor than some other squashes, like zucchini bread. I know it adds some moisture and I'm sure some nutrients, but pumpkin bread does have a pumpkin-y taste.
It does. I think pumpkins are denser. Again, if you're getting the smaller variety, I think they're less watery and therefore the taste is more concentrated. So if you puree it and put it into something, you're really going to get that taste.
Now, people would think, oh, I'll never do this. I'm going to just get a can of puree. And you say it's not that hard.
It's really not. I mean, it's kind of the same. I look at it as the same as if you're making, if you're doing another kind of squash. Basically, to make a puree, you can roast the pumpkin, like I mentioned, cutting it. And then, you know, you want to remove the peel after it's been roasted and let it cool for a minute. Or you can peel it and then cut it up and boil it on the stove. And it is not quite as simple as opening a can, but it's a lot fresher. And I personally think it tastes a lot better. And I have tasted pumpkin pie made from a fresh pumpkin puree, and it doesn't even taste like the regular pie.
Really?
I think it tastes better.
May have to try it. Nicole, thank you so much, and enjoy your Halloween cupcakes.
Thanks, Bonnie. Take care.
That was food writer Nicole Spyridakis. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling went to a big feast at Afghanistan's embassy in Washington, D.C., where he found, among other things, pumpkin stew. He describes the evening to NPR's Leanne Hansen.
Danny, before you tell us what the good news was, I take it that this is an example where food is politics. And not only that, you're going to teach us how to make some traditional Afghan food.
Yeah, food is a powerful messenger, as you know. But first, before we get to the recipe, let me describe the setting. So the ambassador from Afghanistan put up a huge tent on the embassy's terrace, and there were platters and platters and platters of kebabs and spicy spinach and pumpkin stews and long flatbreads called naan and fragile-looking envelopes made of dough and leeks. Here's one of the chefs who was serving the food.
And this is called awshak. It's almost like a dumpling made in leek and meat sauce on the top and seasoned yogurt.
And Leanne, the embassy was throwing this feast to celebrate the fact that a dazzling new exhibition just opened at the National Gallery of Art at the foot of the U.S. Capitol. It's called Afghanistan, Hidden Treasures. Have you read about this or have you seen it?
I read about it. I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, I did hear our colleague Susan Stamberg's report on it, and it just seems like a stunning show. I mean, I heard about these dazzling gold bowls and daggers crusted with jewels, thousands of years old.
Yeah, and the exhibit is going to travel all around the country, so our listeners are going to have a chance to see it. And people from Afghanistan and those cities where the show travels to are going to stage feasts just like this one. I met the wife of the Afghanistan ambassador. Her name is Shamim Jawad, and she understands that food touches people in a very visceral way.
We are hoping to just bring more awareness about Afghanistan and about our rich culture, about our history. As you know, Afghanistan is the crossroad of civilization from east to west. They all went through Afghanistan, and they brought in some of their cuisines, and that's why it's a mix of all these different cultures and ethnic groups. And I personally think our food is like the best.
So, Danny, the embassy used food to remind everybody that Afghanistan still has a wonderful culture despite its problems.
Exactly. And, Leanne, after the party was over, Shamim Jawad invited me to a private cooking lesson so all our listeners can learn to make a traditional eggplant dish. And I want to tell you in advance, this recipe is very easy, and it is really, really delicious.
We are at the kitchen of the Embassy of Afghanistan. Our chef, Mohammed Nasim.
Do you speak English?
Not very well.
Yeah.
Now, you're going to cook an eggplant dish. Well, you are not going to cook it. Your chef is going to kindly cook it. While you explain.
It's eggplant with going to be served on top of yogurt sauce. Mm. We call it Burani Banjan.
So, chef, please go ahead and cook.
Right now, we've chopped the garlic, and he's going to put the garlic on top of the oil, the olive oil.
Take us to Kabul when you were growing up. The sights, the smells.
Remember, it was just this calm, beautiful, peaceful city. We had a house in a big acre of land. I remember the blue sky, the beautiful blue sky of Kabul, the stars, and the calm and the peacefulness and the quiet, and the smell of the bread, the fresh smell of the bread. I remember that. That's the one thing I really miss, because we don't have this here.
Before we talk some more, just tell me, and now, what is he doing?
That's the tomato paste. Tomatoes that he peeled them, peeled the skin off, and now he's just going to put it in the blender to blend them, so he's making the sauce. Tomato paste will go on top of the garlic.
The tomato paste?
You speak very good English.
Yeah, thank you very much, sir.
Tell me a little bit about your family, please, and growing up in Kabul. Were you a wealthy family, a well-known family?
No, we were, you know, Afghans were all not very, very wealthy. We are like kind of a middle class, you know, had comfortable life. Father was working for the government, and my mom was heading a health clinic.
Now this sort of surprises me, and I hope you won't, I hope you'll forgive me for being so ignorant. I sort of assumed that back in those days, in the 1970s, that not many girls would be going to school and university like you did, and not many women would be working.
No. I'm surprised that you're saying that. Many, many girls were going to university and women were working. You know, Afghanistan was one of the countries that women in the 60s, they all had a right to vote, and they worked in the parliament and in the government.
Let's just pause for a moment, and what's going to happen next?
Then, when the sauce is ready, then we will fry the eggplant in a separate pan. Kabul was very westernized in the 70s.
Then the Soviets invaded your country. They first came in the end of 1979, right?
I remember when leaving the house, going to the university as a normal, any other normal days. Then as soon as, like, after 100 meters, I saw the tanks. We were all so scared. We were kind of confused. We didn't know really what happened.
So you had grown up, as you described it, in this lovely home on an acre of land with gardens and everything. How much of your possessions was your family able to take out with them when you escaped?
Basically, a suitcase of clothing. Right now, as you can see, they put the eggplant in the sauce, and as you see, the slice of tomato on top of it and the slice of an onion.
And so now that's going to simmer for...
Yeah, simmer for 10 minutes.
Okay, we'll keep chatting in the meantime while it simmers.
Great, and then we'll be served, and you can taste it.
I'm trying to picture that moment, the first time you got off the plane... back in your country, step foot in Afghanistan for the first time in, more than 20 years?
More than 20 years. It was in January of 2003. It was just this incredible moment because we never thought that we'd be able to go back, because we thought the way things were in the past 30 years, I mean, one thing after another thing, and then Taliban, which was the worst of all. And I remember I looked up and I looked at that blue sky. That is so beautiful. But then, of course, as soon as I got off and I got on the car and I started going towards where my husband was staying, then I realized what happened to my country. It was ruined building everywhere. I could not identify one standing solid building anywhere. There was no trees on the streets. All the trees were chopped.
This was a different country than you had left.
And the thing I remembered the most, there were children everywhere. young children at 4 years old, 5 years old, begging for money. So that broke my heart. He's preparing the yogurt sauce.
Oh.
So what he's doing is he's chopping some garlic and putting it in the yogurt sauce for the taste.
Ooh, yum. So let's leap ahead now to now, yeah. 2008. You go back and forth to Afghanistan frequently.
Yeah.
How does it compare with the Afghanistan before the Soviets came, before you fled?
Oh, tremendous change. Amazing, amazing. Every time I go, I feel so happy when I see the rebuilding. I mean, the face of the Kabul changed completely. The roads are built. There's the lines of shops. They're planting trees again everywhere.
As you know, a lot of Americans, I think, have the sense now that Afghanistan, despite the U.S. invasion, that Afghanistan is a mess and dangerous.
Well, they need to realize this is a country that it took them 30 years to destroy it, and it was destroyed completely. We lost the whole infrastructure. So then we started from scratch, from zero, 6 years ago. I mean, I just think it's so unfair when you hear the media just criticizing everything. I mean, they don't see the positive side. 6 years ago, women were not allowed to leave home. Girls were not allowed to go to school. Now, 6 million children are going back to school, 40% are girls. Girls are back to university, boys or girls are studying again. Women are going back to work as a teachers. We have women as a governor, women run for a president. Oh, this is a major accomplishment. Why they don't talk about that?
Okay, so now a little yogurt on each plate, like a little pond of yogurt.
Yeah.
Each eggplant is covered with a hat made of a onion ring, a thick tomato slice, and a little slice of slightly spicy pepper. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a very good combination. Voila, it's done.
And by the way, Leanne, just before he served it, the chef sprinkled the plate with sprigs of parsley and cilantro, and then Shamim Jawad and I sat down at the embassy's long, long banquet table. And we savored it.
You know, it sounds like something I'm going to try in my kitchen as soon as the show is over.
You should. Oh, and speaking of food, the ambassador's wife has been helping a group that clears landmines from fields in Afghanistan, and then they plant crops there. So when she went to visit President Karzai recently at the presidential palace, she presented him with a crate filled with grapes and pomegranates. They had just been harvested from the same fields that used to be planted with death.
Great story. NPR's Danny Swerdling. Thanks a lot.
Leanne, thanks a lot.
To see an audio slideshow with step-by-step instructions on how to make a traditional Afghan eggplant dish, go to npr.org.
If you're still not sold on the culinary virtue of the pumpkin, there is an alternative this time of year. There may be even more apples than pumpkins at fall farm stands. Master baker and author Dori Greenspan stopped by the home kitchen of NPR's Michelle Norris to demonstrate what to do with all those apples.
I always peel the apples, but what I usually do is I peel them and I end up eating the peel. Then I'm always surprised there's nothing to toss out.
Shoo, fly, fly, an apple fan, Dottie makes your eyes light up. Your thumb is here, hobby. Shoo, fly, fly, an apple fan, Dottie, I'll never get enough of that wonderful star.
Dori Greenspan had me doing all kinds of stuff last week, working in my own kitchen, peeling, coring, and quartering a mess of fresh Fuji apples. Dori is the author of Baking, From My Home to Yours, and for the past year, she's been helping me master ever more difficult recipes.
Let's go to the stove. Get some heat under it and melt the butter.
On today's agenda, tarte tatin. It's sort of like an apple pan dowdy or a cobbler, except it's French, and it's the terror of many a home baker.
This is really, for a dessert that everyone is so afraid of, it's a really kind of loosey-goosey operation. You do it once, and you won't even need a recipe to do it again.
Why so wary? All we need is a stick of butter, sugar, apples, and rolled-out pie dough. You can also use puff pastry. Plus, my heavy cast iron skillet. We also need a great big platter that fits over the heavy cast iron skillet, thick oven mitts, and perhaps some Wheaties.
Okay, so we have 3/4 cup of sugar on top of the bubbling butter, and now we're going to turn off the heat.
Now hold up, the Wheaties don't go in the tart tatin, they go in us, because we're going to need some muscle. A tart tatin is first prepared over a stove. We've melted the butter, added the sugar, and now we have to arrange the first layer of apples in that skillet, like letter C's, with the curved side facing down.
Think about a pineapple upside down cake, okay? What's at the bottom of the pan will eventually be the top of our dessert. You can fuss and figure out a pattern, but somehow, no matter what you do, this tart always looks beautiful.
A bit of history. This is a dessert that comes with a wonderful story.
What we know for sure is that there were two sisters in the Loire Valley, the Tatin sisters, and they had an inn where they cooked for their guests. One of the stories that I've heard, one of the sisters was making an apple tart, and she had put it in the oven when she realized that there was no dough under the apples. So, and thinking quickly, she had people outside in the dining room and she had things to do in the kitchen. She just took the dough and put it on top of the apples and then flipped it over and served it that way. And it was evidently so delicious that they continued to make it. And if you go to the area where the Tatin sisters lived, there are tart tatin societies that get together. There are official recipes. There are unofficial ones. It's really a cult sweet.
Two layers of apples later, the heat's back on. We stand over the stove, watching and listening to the apples caramelize in that butter-sugar mix. After about 15 minutes, the bubbles have gotten fatter, the apples soften, my kitchen smells divine, and I am getting hungry.
Okay, so while we...
I really would love to take one of those apples.
No, too hot. Can't. Okay, I like the color. Darker than butterscotch.
And getting darker by the minute.
There's a moment where it turns brown, and then it turns really brown, and then it's time to stop.
So we take the skillet off the burner, then cover the apples with a blanket of rolled-out pie dough, carefully tucking around the inside edges of the pan before moving the entire skillet, the entire thing, into the oven. Then we wait. And we wait some more. We wait 35 minutes. It feels like an eternity.
It's showtime.
Let's go. How does it look?
Oh, it's still bubbling.
Yes.
Dory, it's beautiful.
Well, the top is beautiful. We don't know what's underneath.
But we're going to find out what's below that flaky golden crust. Dory rolls up her sleeves, dons the oven mitts, and then prepares to do the tatin flip.
Yeah, actually, what it takes is a little bit of strength and a lot of courage. Hold this.
So the platter is on top of the skillet.
Right.
And you're trying to lift the platter and the skillet.
Over. Oh. Okay, now. You better taste good.
Wait, we're not done yet. Now, you can understand why some people think a tart tatin is kind of a bear. Dory grips the now upside-down skillet, then very carefully lifts the pan up in one careful motion.
Now, often some apples get stuck. Let's see.
There it is. The tart tatin is gorgeous. Oh. Not perfect apple pie gorgeous, but French country gorgeous. Yes. Ooh la la, rustic. The apples rest on top of the dough, covered with brown caramelized sugar. Some are browned a bit more than the others. They look sweet and tender, and they glisten under the kitchen lights.
We can't eat it now. It's really way too hot to eat.
Why can't we eat it now?
I got a good look because we had to wait a few more minutes before we could finally dig in.
Oh, now that is delicious. It's screaming out for fresh whipped cream.
Fresh whipped cream would be great.
Mm-hmm.
Vanilla
creme
ice
fresh.
Cream. Creme fraiche, definitely.
Now, I am thinking of the sister who pulled this out of the oven, basically covered up a mistake, if we believe that story.
If we believe that story.
And has guests in the dining room, and she's wondering they're either going to love it or... Or maybe she knew immediately when she took it out that she had come on to something wonderful.
I think she probably thought, I hope they like it.
I think this needs to be continued off the radio. So we can enjoy this fabulous dessert. Because best when eaten warm, yes?
Best when eaten warm.
That was NPR's Michelle Norris with baker Dori Greenspan. Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and lots of recipes for pumpkins and apples. Join us next time. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.